All right, today, Rav Yosef Cairo and the Rama. Okay. Now, 1492, as we know, that was the expulsion from Spain. And it was traumatic. We already spoke last week that the golden age of Spain started to come to a close in the period of the Ramban. But it officially comes to a close 200 years later in 1492. Jews had enjoyed freedom in Spain. Many were very wealthy. Two served as ministers for the king of Spain, Don Yitzhak Abarbanel and Rav Avraham Senior. Okay, these people, they worked for the king. They were Rabbanim. And when the choice was given for the Jews to either baptize or leave Spain, I mentioned last week, half the Jewish population chose to become Christian and to stay, including Avram Senior. Avram Senior was this Rav. He chose to stay on as a minister for the king. Now, the Abarbanel did not. The Abarbanel left, even though the king actually gave him permission to stay as a Jew. He left, holding a Sefer Torah, leading out tens of thousands of Jews from Spain. And with this, 750 years of Spanish Jewry comes to an end. Now, this was traumatic. Some of the Jews stayed in Spain. They were secret Jews, Moranos, Conversos, however you want to refer to them. This was traumatic, certainly when they were found out and they had to leave afterwards. You had 50,000 Jews who died on ships leaving Spain, going to other countries. 50,000 Jews. Okay? And as with most tragedies in Jewish history, Jews tried to read something good into it, and they said, this must be Chevle Mashiach. If there was such a terrible thing like this, so this must be Chevle Mashiach. Mashiach must be right around the corner. Now, one of those expelled from Spain was a teenager named Yaakov Beirav. He was such an Eloi. Eloi means what? Genius, child prodigy, that at the ripe old age of 18, how old you guys are, he was named chief rabbi of Fez. Fez was a large Jewish city in Morocco. 5,000 people lived in the city. And this 18-year-old, he was named the chief rabbi of Fez. He later moves on to Tzfat, and he becomes the leading rav in Tzfat. And he's involved in a huge controversy. He tries to reinstitute smicha. Now, what does that mean? Real smicha ended about 1,000 years before of Yaakov Beirav. Okay, with real smicha, you can do certain things that nowadays Rabbanim cannot do. The smicha that I have just allows me to paskin shaylas, right? Ordinarily not supposed to paskin in front of your Rebbe. Your Rebbe gives you smicha and says, all right, you're knowledgeable enough that you can paskin questions. That's it. But real smicha gives you added benefits, which I'll get to in a moment. Now, he wants to reinstitute the Sanhedrin. Why? Two ideas. One idea is messianic fervor. Everyone's talking about the Mashiach must be coming. If you look in the Shmoneh Esrei, you see that the brachot of Hashiveinu Shavtenu Karishona, Hashiva Shavtenu Karishona, that bracha comes before its Tzemach David. And there's a Gemara in Megillah that we're going to see after Pesach that says the order of the Shmoneh Esrei has chronological significance. And therefore, before Mashiach can come, Sanhedrin's got to be up and running. So he wanted to reinstitute the Sanhedrin so that Mashiach would be able to come. One reason. Second reason given is the Moranos. As I mentioned before, when the Goyim found out that Jews were actually secretly, people who were baptized, were coming to church, were actually secret Jews, they were more angry with them than the original Jews, and they were kicked out. They now come to Tzfat, and they beg for Malchus. They say, look, what we did was awful. We know that we're going to suffer terribly in Olam Haba. And there's a Mishnah in Malkos that says that even if you're Chayiv Karis, it's possible to get Malkos and wipe the slate clean. And they say, we for sure did that. We cut ourselves off from the Jewish people. That's exactly what we did. For sure God's going to do the same to us. We need, right? Christianity could be a Avodah Zarah. We need Malkos now. So, based on this idea, also, only a basin of real smuchim can minister lashes. So this is the second idea that is given. why he wanted to reinstitute the smicha. Now, how did he do it? Based on a reading of a Rambam. So Rambam in Hilchos Sanhedrin, Perek Dalet, Halacha Yud Aleph, his understanding of this Rambam was, if all the Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael feel that someone is worthy of smicha, then like he just becomes already a musmach. And then he can give smicha. So after he gave the shir, all the Rabbanim Tzfat said, hey, you're the man. Okay. So that was it. Fastest smicha ever. He then gave smicha out to four of his Talmidim, one of them being Rav Yosef Kairo. Now, he also sent smicha, one of his four, to the Rav of Yushalayim. Okay? The Rav of Yushalayim, Rav Levi Ibn Chaviv. He got upset. And the smicha, why did it become controversial? Two reasons. One, Yerushalayim. Two, the Turkish Empire. Yerushalayim. Okay, smicha is given to him. He gets in the mail, special delivery. You now have smicha, right? So Rabbi Levi Ibn Chaviv says, what are you talking about? First of all, he says, who do you think you are? Ki mitzion teitzei Torah, right? It's all about Yerushalayim. Now, it's true, qualitatively and quantitatively, there were more Talmidei Chachamim in Tzfat. But out of kavod for Yerushalayim, he's saying, what? You're just like deciding that the Talmidei Chachamim of Eretz Yisrael happen all to be in Tzfat? Yerushalayim doesn't even rate? So he's very disturbed about, you know, the disrespect shown to Yerushalayim. And second, he says, you don't know how to learn a Rambam. Rambam doesn't say that. Okay? The Radbaz living in Egypt also didn't learn the Rambam the way that Rav Yaakov Beirav did. So this is problem number one, the Jews. Problem number two, the Turks. Right, what's the problem? The Turkish Empire viewed this as a rebellion against their authority. All of a sudden, now you're having your own Sanhedrin, you're going to decide things. We're running the show. And this is what happened to the point that Rav Yaakov Beirav actually had to flee. The end of his life, he had to live out in Damascus because the Turks were not too happy with his decision to start a Sanhedrin. Now, Rav Yosef Kairo, who received smicha, he himself gave smicha to Rav Moshe Alshech, right? We have Svarim even translated into English in the back, okay? The Alshech, who in turn gave smicha to Rav Chaim Vital. But it sort of ended there. Controversy just was getting too big that it wasn't, what was your smicha worth if no one recognized it? Similar thing happened here in the 1990s. Rav Adin Steinsaltz wanted to set up a Sanhedrin, maybe also messianic fervor that must be Mashiach's coming. And also, it was controversial, also didn't take hold. But this is what Rav Yaakov Beirav tried to do. Now, Rav Yosef Kairo was born in 1488 in Spain. So at the ripe old age of four, he and his family had to leave with the expulsion from Spain, and he makes his way to Turkey. He becomes a huge Talmud Chacham, and in 1536, at the age of 48, he now makes his way to Tzfat. He's already a well-known Talmud Chacham. When he arrives, Rav Yaakov Beirav appoints him to be the Av Beis Din in Tzfat. He had already begun working on his magnum opus, the Beit Yosef, and he continues working on it here in Tzfat. Now, this Beis Din that he presided over might have been one of the greatest Batei Dinim since the Churban. You had so many all-stars that were on this Beis Din. Certainly was the greatest of its time. Now, it's interesting. This small community, Tzfat, probably had between 200 and 300 families, right? Half the size of the community that I live in, which is pretty tiny. And yet, you had some of the greatest Talmidei Chachamim in both Nigla and Nistar living in one small place at one time. Yerushalayim, you go to these different landmarks, and all these great people lived here, but they lived here over many different generations. You go to Tzfat, and you visit all of these shuls and all of these sites, every single great, they're all there, you know, shopping in the same supermarket. They were all there together at the same time. That's what makes Tzfat, like, so impressive. Torah Tanistar, mystical. Who do you have? You're Shlomo Alkabitz. Shlomo Alkabitz wrote many Svarim, one of which, Manot HaLevi. It's a parish on Megillat Esther. Okay, those of you guys learning Megillat Esther. So Manot HaLevi. He wrote a lot of Svarim. He was a huge Talmid Chacham, and yet, he's most well known for a poem that he wrote. What poem? Lecha Dodi. right? Shlomo Alevi spelled out. Now, this song, like, I think if you would ask him before he died, all the things you did in your life, you know, what's the most significant things? I don't think he would have put Lecha Dodi up there, and yet that's what he's most known for. Okay? Most people, if they've heard his name, it's for Lecha Dodi. Now, the poem, the song, it's pretty amazing. Within 30 years, it spread worldwide, all over the world. You couldn't find a shul within 30 years that wasn't saying Lecha Dodi. So this is like an amazing, amazing thing. He became the Rebbe in Kabbalah of his brother-in-law. You might have heard of his name, Rav Moshe Cordova. Rav Moshe Cordova. Have you heard his name? What did he write? Talmud Devorah, Parashat Sharon. Very good. Now, Rav Moshe Cordova was a member of the Beis Din of Rav Yosef Kairu. He was a Talmud of Rav Yosef Kairu. He was a huge Talmud Chacham in Torah Tanigla. Rav Yosef Kairu in his Shilut and Shuvot, Afkat Rochel, he quotes his student, Rav Moshe Cordova, in Halacha, not in Kabbalah, in Halacha. He was holding in Shas and Poskim. Okay, later, he goes on to become the Rav of the Mekubalim in Sfat. Now, a young Jew from Egypt, at the age of 36, makes his way to Tzfat. And his name is Rabbi Yitzhak Luria. How do we know him? Who's Rabbi Yitzhak Luria? You guys know. Anyone know? The Arizal, very good. Now, he differs from the Ramak, Rav Moshe Cordova, in two important ways. One, Rav Moshe Cordova, he taught an elite, small group of people Kabbalah. And the Ari made it more popular and taught larger groups. Okay? Number two, the Ari was also into Kabbalah Ma'asit, practical Kabbalah. Right? Not just, oh, that's a really cool theoretical idea, but let's use this mystical stuff to do things. So you'd write, let's say, a kamiya. What's a kamiya? Amulet. Amulet that if you wore this, it would ward away evil spirits or help you get well if you were sick. He'd use, let's say, different incantations to help cure people. Maybe even make a golem or two. Who knows? But this is Kabbalah Ma'asit. Okay. The Ari, this is what they write about him. He could tell you the meaning of the chirping of birds. What they meant. He could tell you the meaning of leaves rustling. And certainly could tell you about the angels that happened to be having a conversation here in the room that you didn't even see. There's like this crazy story where the Alshech was once giving a shir in a shul. The Alshech was this great darshan. And he was giving this shir about all the different ways that Lavan tried to trick Yaakov Avinu. And while he's giving the shir, first the Ari starts to smile, then he starts to chuckle, and before you know it, he's like cracking up. It's a little disconcerting if you're giving a shir, some guy in the back is laughing at everything you say. When he was finished, the Alshech like says to him, what's with all the laughing? He said, no, you don't get it. Like, Lavan was sitting here in the shul, and every time he said something, he was going, yup, I did that too, yup, that too, that too. So this is the Ari. The Ari could look at you, and he could see all the different sins you've done. And that's why people never really wanted to shake his hand and say good Shabbos. He's like, yo, Shabbat Shalom, Rebbe, walk out, right? He just take one. He could see all the sins you did in previous lives. He can tell you what you're doing in this world, what kind of effect it's having up in Shamayim. Okay, this theory, all the kfarim of these like Nevi'im and Rishon, not Rishonim, Tanoim and Amoraim, you go to Tzfat and you have these kfarim, it's the Ari that told us, oh, he knows buried right over here? Yeah, here, this part. Oh, he knows buried over here? Like all the markings, this Ari did it. He just like walked and he said, oh, this buried over here is this person. Buried over here is this person. He chose Rav Chaim Vital to convey his message to the world and he basically wrote the Ari's Torahs. Now, the Ari, who is such an important figure in Sfat, right? When you mention Sfat, the first name that comes to mind is the Ari. He only lived in Sfat for 2 years. He died at the age of 38 in Sfat. Yes, what do you want to say?
Did he tell us where the Rambam was buried?
I don't know. Rav Chaim Vital tells us the following story. Said he had a dream that deceased Rav Moshe Cordova, the Ramak, came to him and said that both his and the Ari's schools of Kabbalah are correct, but the Ramak's school is more for the beginners. And now even he, up in Shemayim, is just learning the Ari's view on Kabbalah. Okay. So don't worry, we'll be able to continue learning up in Shamayim. In Nigla, you also have tremendous Talmid Chacham, the Al-Sheikh I mentioned, the Mabit, who had lots of different opinions with Rav Yosef Cairo. We have the Chuvat of the Mabit in the library across the hall. Now, Rav Yosef Cairo said he worked on the Beis Yosef, started in Turkey, continues in Sfat. 20 years he worked on his Beis Yosef. Another 12 years revising it. One story that I heard from a tour guide, that's where most of my information is from, tour guides in Sfat, was that the Rav Yosef Cairo was davening for the Amid once, and he finished the Shmon Esrei, and the Ari hadn't yet finished. I guess with all the mystical kavanas, it took him long. So he was waiting for him before he started his Chazrat HaShatz. And it was taking a while. He looked out the window. He sees some guy walking with a donkey laden with sacks. And he starts to think, well, what if those sacks had flour? Would the sweat, he's already like working on Hilchas Pesach there at that time, would the sweat, would that turn into chametz? Is it possible this would be chametz? He's going through in his mind the different shitas, what would be. Meanwhile, the Ari finished the Shmon Esrei. He's like, banging up. Okay. And Rav Yosef Cairo is just lost. He walks over, taps on the shoulder, goes, I'm finished. And by the way, it wouldn't be chametz according to any opinion. Okay. So this is the stories that they tell about the Ari. Now, Rav Yosef Cairo, why did he write the Beis Yosef? He said that Jews were not really living in peace and serenity. They were constantly on the move. And therefore, they didn't really have the time to learn a sugya well, to understand all the opinions and arrive at the halacha. And therefore, he felt the Torah was starting to splinter. There was no universal sefer in halacha since the Rambam. And the Rambam, he felt, was lacking two vital things. One, his reasoning is not there. And two, his sources aren't there. Both of which Rav Yosef Cairo tried to help us with by writing a commentary on the Rambam. What did he write on the Rambam? Anyone know? Kesef Mishnah. Good. Kesef Mishnah. Very good. Okay?
I got it.
Okay. The other guys are just more modest. They all know it. Because it didn't have reasons, because it didn't have sources, didn't give divergent opinions, and there was a lot of non-halacha lemaisa, he decided to write his Beis Yosef on the Tor. Who wrote the Tor? The son of the Rosh. Very good. Rav Yaakov Balaturim. He wrote also the Balaturim we have on Chumash. Rav Yaakov Balaturim. So we have the four volumes of the Tor. What are the four volumes of the Tor? Eben Ezer. Hoshem Mishpat. Yerodayan. Arachim. Okay, what's Arachim about? Daily Halacha. What's Hoshem Mishpat about? Monetary. What's Eben Ezer about? Marital stuff. And what's Yerodayan about? Everything else. All the ritual matters. He said only Halacha L'maisa. Only Halacha L'maisa stuff. Bezrat Hashem. It's very good. It's very important. Right? Bezrat Hashem. Very soon we'll have Karbanu, we'll have Karban Pesach. So all the ritual laws that don't fit into the other stuff, right? It's all there. Okay? Kashrus and Avelus and Edus. That's all like in Yerodea. Okay? So he wrote his Beit Yosef on that. Okay? You open up a tour, you see on the inside, you know, you have like the Beis Yosef, his perishing. Now, what does he do? He goes through the sugi. If the Torah just says, I know this thing is mukta, he explains, he quotes the Gemara and Beitza, he goes through all the Rishonim, till he gets to his final halacha. For the most part, 99.9% of the time, he decides halacha based on three pillars of halacha. Who are his go-to guys? Rambam? The Rush and the Riff, yes. As opposed to the Rough and the Rish, yes. So Rambam, Rif, and Rush, okay? They are the three pillars of halacha. When he doesn't paskin, according to the majority of those opinions, that's when all the mefarshim, you know, have a field day trying to figure out why. But for the most part, you know, this is what he will do. Later on, he realized, after he finished, he says, wow, the average person doesn't want to go through five pages of commentary to find out what bracha to make on an apple. So he then wrote a concise version of the Beit Yosef. This only took a few weeks. He divided it into 30 different parts, so you can review one part each day. And every month, know all the halachas, so you need to know. What is this little tiny paperback called? The Shulchan Aruch, right? The Shulchan Aruch is really tiny if you take out all of the Mefarshim. Right? On the page that we open up a Shulchan Aruch, you know, 90% of it are as Perushim. So the Shulchan Aruch is really one small little book that you could learn monthly. You could, you know, you just learn, it's divided into 30 parts, very simple, and you go over all of the halacha you need to know. This was, you know, this was what you, for him, this was the Kitzer. Okay, we then made a Kitzer, but this was the Kitzer Beis Yosef. Now, we sit there and look at the Shulchan Aruch and say, wow, everyone learns the Shulchan Aruch. Not so when it began. This was a very controversial Sefer. Okay, did not immediately meet with worldwide acceptance. One of the biggest opponents was the Marshal. Marshal, Rosh Shlomo Luria, as far as I know, not related to Rabbi Yitzhak Luria, certainly not immediate relatives. He attacked the Beit Yosef, the attacked the Shulchan Aruch. He says the Shulchan Aruch is mostly his attacks. Why? He says it's not the way to learn halacha. You don't have it spoon-fed to you. You have to go through the sugya. You have to look at the Rishonim, and you have to come to understanding of what you think the halacha is. There's one problem. Number two, it makes it too easy, right? So the way that we argued that Rashi would make it too easy to learn Gemara, so now all these handbooks, you look at this, all these shelves over handbooks of halacha, says, what? That's not the way to learn halacha. You go pick out this book and it just tells you all the halacha. That's what you did. She made this little handbook of halacha. That's not the way to learn halacha. Number three, this one for sure is problematic, but that's what the Mefarshim deal with it. It basically turns the Shulchan Aruch into something static. Halacha is a living organism. I mean, if it's not in the Shulchan Aruch, people won't know what to do. What happens if things evolve afterwards? New innovations, new technological advances, and it's not written in the Shulchan Aruch. What would we do? He made this thing as if, okay, it stops here. Here's the last word in halacha. And number four, which is always going to be someone saying it, who let you decide the halacha? Like, who made you the final arbiter in halacha? There's always going to be someone that's going to say that whenever someone writes a halacha sefer. What? Rav Yosef Cairo, yes. Rav Yosef Cairo learned with a malach. At night he had, it's called a magid, okay? And there's a sefer, you can find it in some sfarim, so it's Magid Misharim, where the magid taught him Kabbalistic ideas, and he like spoke it, like in other words, he didn't have his voice. All of a sudden this other voice came, speaking through him, and he wrote down what he learned. But what's interesting though, is none of that makes it into the Shulchan Aruch. Right? Even though in the Magid Misharim he's taught all sorts of Kabbalistic stuff, doesn't make its way into the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch is Rambam, Rif, and Rush. Okay? Now, how you understand that, okay?
He might make up maybe from the Malach, from the Kabbalistic stuff, putting on your right shoe first, then your left shoe first. Yes, has to be as right.
From what I remember reading, I once read this book, really not a nice commentary. Okay, this guy named, right? This guy named Worobalski, if I remember correctly, Worobalski, something like that. He wrote a book called Joseph Cairo, something like, I don't know, Judge, Halach, Mystic, I don't know, Decisor and Madman. He didn't think that he was having visits from an angel. He thought he was psychotic. Right, certainly was not very complimentary about him. But like I said, his mystical teachings, you can find it. It's in the Magid Misharim. It doesn't make its way into the Shulchan Aruch. Now, in the end, the Shulchan Aruch does gain worldwide acceptance, possibly because of what the Ramah does, which we'll get to in a moment. And in a sense, he actually completes the drive of his Rebbe. His Rebbe, Rav Yaakov Berav, wanted to create a Sanhedrin. But he got stopped, didn't make it to the end zone. Okay? Rav Yosef Cairo sort of, what was the idea of having a Sanhedrin? Having a central body of halacha. The Shulchan Aruch sort of became a written Sanhedrin. It turns out that for years, for centuries since, everyone consults the Shulchan, every Rav who goes and gets smicha has to start, not start, but has to consult the Shulchan Aruch, which has sort of become like a, like I said, a sort of a Sanhedrin in a book. Now, is it the last word? No, we have all these Mefarshim afterwards. But no one sits there and says, I don't have to look at the Shulchan Aruch. So the Shulchan Aruch, to a certain extent, became sort of what his Rebbe wanted to do, having a centralized sefer. But like I said, I think it has a lot to do with the Ramah, who I'm up to right now. What's Ramah's name? What country did he live in? Wrong answer. What? Poland. Now his years are 1530. Now Rav Yosef Kairo, 1488 to 1575. He lived a nice long life, 87. It's old even by today's standards. The Rama, 1530 to 1572. Died at the age of 42 in a cholera epidemic. Some actually say he didn't even make it to 42. He died at the age of 33. He died at the age of 33 on the 33rd day of the Omer, and he had published 33 Sfarim. Okay, we only have 17, Nebuch, right? 17 Sfarim, it's not a lot. But could be that he actually wrote 33. We just don't have all the Sfarim. But it's a lot that he produced for someone so young. Okay, someone so young. What? He did. He actually wrote on Megillat Esther as he was once away from his father-in-law, and he couldn't send him Shalach Manos, so he wrote a Perush on Megillat Esther and sent it to him as in lieu of Shalach Manos. The Rama, his was a pilgrimage on Lag BaOmer. For those who haven't been here yet for Lag BaOmer, Rav Shimon Bar Yochai's kever in Meron becomes a pilgrimage. Tens of thousands of Jews go to visit Rashbi on Lag BaOmer. We go every other day of the year, you know, in our yeshiva. That day, Rabina says don't go, but we go almost every other day. And the Ramaz kever was that pilgrimage. Jews came from all over Europe to visit the kever of the Raman, learn from the Ramaz Sfarim on Lag BaOmer. This was done up until basically World War II. But this is what was done. He ended up marrying the daughter of his Rosh Yeshiva at the age of 15. Okay, at the age of 15, the Rosh Yeshiva already saw that he was the best guy in Yeshiva. And by the age of 20, his Rosh Yeshiva was appointed the chief rabbi in Poland and now appoints the Rama to be the chief rav of Krakow. Chief Rav of Krakow. Now, when the Archbishop of Krakow heard that a huge Talmud Chacham is coming to Krakow, he was very excited, said this is going to add to the prestige of the community. And once some 20-year-old, you know, showed up, you know, Ashkenazi, probably wasn't even shaving yet, he like looked at him and said, what? You're the Chief Rabbi of Krakow? He was so upset that he wanted to evict all the Jews from Krakow. So the Rama said, I'm willing to debate anyone you want to put up from the church. And they did. They had a debate. And the church father started to speak. And he spoke to him in Latin. And everyone there was aghast. What Jew knows Latin? Certainly some rabbinic student. And the Rama replied in flawless Latin and blew him away. And he was holding in all sorts of general knowledge and all sorts of sciences to the point that from then on they never messed with him. And he was the Rav of Krakow. And even though he was so young, all the Rabbanim looked up to the Rama. They understood his genius. He opened the yeshiva in Krakow, and he supported the students himself. He was very wealthy. He got a lot of money from an inheritance, and he turned a small fortune into a large fortune based on, you know, his fortunate business deals. And therefore, he didn't take a salary, and basically he financed the yeshiva that he ran. Now, he was so caring to his students that we have literature from the students writing not about what great Talmud Chacham he was, but how much he cared for them, you know, and he cared for them like a father would for his son. Aside from Torah, he was also an expert in philosophy, so much so that he was known as the Rambam of Polish Jewry. And here, he now, you know, gets it on his head from his cousin, the Marshal. The Marshal who attacked the Beit Yosef also attacks the Ramah. And they were first cousins. And he says, what is with you? How could you be studying philosophy? It's Bittul Torah. Who gave you permission to study philosophy? So I find his answers to be fantastic. First of all, he says, get off my back. Machlokas yashanahi. Why do you think you're the first person to bring this up? In the Gemara, we already have machlokas back and forth, whether or not you can study secular studies, and there's no definitive answer in the Gemara. This has been debated by the Rishonim, and you're like, all of a sudden you discovered America, and you're coming over to me, Bittel, to get off my back. That's first thing. Second thing is, I don't learn Aristotle in the original. I'm reading it in the Rambam, quoting the Aristotle, so I guess somehow that's better. And third is the part that I find most interesting. I only learn it on Shabbos. So I thought this was fascinating because I decided, oh, I'm really frum. Throughout high school and college, I would never study for a secular studies, a test. I would study on Shabbos. I wouldn't study on weekdays either so much. But on Shabbos, and my parents, I can't study now. It's Shabbos. You can't study for this on Shabbos. And here it is. What does the Rama say? Only on Shabbos I would do it. In other words, what? I wasn't mevatel my zman. I have mornings, I have afternoons, Seder, Aviv. Of course, I'm not Mavatos Man. But in Shabbos, when everyone's taking a nap, or they're going in a little spatzir around town with their wives, I'm sitting and I'm learning philosophy. So it's not Bittel's Man at all. So I find it very interesting. Now, at this point, what does the Marshal say to him? Well, if you have so much time on your hands, why don't you work on your diktuk? Your grammar stinks. To which he responds, I find this also really cute. His name is Moshe. He says, what can I do? Kvad peh v'kvad lashon anochi. You know, so he says, I hope everyone's getting the gist of what I'm trying to say. I feel the same way whenever I speak in my shul. Hope they're getting the gist of what I say. I know I'm making millions of grammatical mistakes. All right. Now, he's most well known for his Darchei Moshe. Darchei Moshe, according to most historians, he was doing the exact same thing in Poland that the Beis Yosef was doing in Tzfat. He just didn't know. He also decided that it was important to trace the sugya, go through the Gemaras, go through the Rishonim, come to the bottom line halacha. Before he can get to the publisher, someone comes in, Rebbe, look at this new Sefer that was just printed in Eretz Yisrael. It's called the Beit Yosef. Now, first of all, why is the Beit Yosef even called the Beit Yosef? He writes his introduction. It's very cute. He says the way that Yosef supported the Jews in their difficult exile. Now the Jews, as I said, were moving around from place to place. This Sefer will support them. And also his name was Yosef, and also this became his bayit. But you know, all that together, Beit Yosef. Darchei Moshe. Clearly, this is the way of Moshe. Right? Is Moshe, Rav Moshe Isserles. He was the same thing, but the Beis Yosef beat into the publisher. What would most Jews do? In fact, 99.9% of Jews do. Publish their book and say, mine's better. Right? But he didn't do that. He said, look, when it comes down to it, we agree on almost everything. But while the Beit Yosef only looked at the Rif, the Rush, and the Rambam, two out of three, Sfardim and the Rush, half his life also lived in Spain, he said, what happened to the Baalei Tosos? What happened to the Rav Yah, Shurmas Adeshin? You don't look at any of the Ashkenazi Poskim. You know, what's about Halakha Kabasra? Like, so there were differences of opinion only there. Would he write a comment? So when you open up the tour, you'll see the Beis Yosef, and you'll see on the bottom the Darchei Moshe where he disagrees. Where he doesn't disagree, there's no need to write it. And when the Shulchan Aruch wrote his little handbook that he called the Shulchan Aruch, what does Shulchan Aruch mean? The set table. He said, oh, but it's not really elegant until you have the tablecloth. So he made the mapa. He made the mapa. And he just did the same thing. The tiny little differences where you end up, the halacha is like this. So where we disagree, it's over here. You say, kaparis is a ridiculous minhag. You shouldn't do it. It's darchei amori. You know, so he says, hey, that's our minhag. We Ashkenazim, we've been doing it all. We've been doing it. We do it with women, men, with babies. That's our minhag. So he writes it in because we have to know. That's our minhag. So this is what the Rama did. By doing this, he made the Sefer universally acceptable. Every Ashkenazi knows what the Sfardim hold. Every Sfardim holds what the Ashkenazim hold. And it became the Sefer that everybody looks to. Right? By doing this, I think the Rama basically turned this Sefer into, you know, like I said, the Sefer that everyone has to consult and the Sefer that everyone decided that I'm going to write my Mefarshim, my commentary on that Sefer. Right, you don't find all the commentaries in other Sfarim of Halacha. On this Sefer, it became the Halacha. All right, we'll stop over here. Next week, a Purim